Welcome to the Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Sperger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take back into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours or alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Oh, honey, someone must have pre-hijacked me. I would never sign up for Ashley Madison, I swear.
Famous last words. All right, so the first article we have is hackers can hack your online accounts before you even register them.
Pre-crime.
Not exactly. Although it would be awesome if, you know, anybody caught doing this would get hit with a six stick.
I actually don't like that. The first sentence of this article exchanges the hack for hijack. So this, like the title itself is just misleading. It's not hacking.
Well, I mean, you gotta get quakes.
That's fair.
But this comes to us from Bleeping Computer. So it turns out that attackers can hijack online accounts before you registered by exploiting verification flaws. So this is based on some research by Andrew Perver, who's a researcher at Microsoft's Security Response Center, and Avinash Sudana, I don't know, my pronunciation is terrible, who's an independent researcher. And this was done using some funding that Microsoft provided, $75,000 for proposals to improve the security identity solution. So these flaws that they identified were actually found in the wild or affecting several well-known sites such as Instagram, LinkedIn, Zoom, WordPress, and Dropbox.
Wait, weren't you telling me before we started that this was a dead simple thing that should have never occurred?
Yes. And we'll get to that in a second.
All right.
But the solution to fix this is pretty simple. But how it's done is there's actually five different methods for doing this pre-registration account takeover. All the hacker needs to know up front is the target's email address. So the attacker creates an account on one of these sites that has this vulnerability in it, using that email, and they basically create an account that with that email address as the user, as the username, or as part of the registration. And hopefully any email which is sent to the user's account is not seen by the user or is caught into spam folder or something, so they don't see the notification email that the account's been created.
I mean, I don't know what I would do if I got one of these. Like if I didn't have an Instagram and I got one saying, thank you for signing up to Instagram, I'd probably just assume it was a fish and delete it.
Yeah, I probably would do the same thing also. Because that's one thing about the attackers has to, I mean, this attack really is for, I would imagine it's for a pretty relatively popular site because it created an account on, you know, bobsbaittackle.com. What's the likelihood that somebody else or your target is going to go and register an account there? Seems pretty slim unless they have a way to lure you there to create an account, or it's a site that's popular enough that virtually everyone eventually creates one.
And what's the end goal there too? Like Bob's Bait and Tackle, what exactly are you going to gain from it? Maybe a credit
fishing
card.
Lures, obviously.
You need the lures for your phishing campaigns. Ah, I should have seen that.
Oh, man. So you're not thinking far enough ahead.
See, this is why I'm a terrible hacker.
All right. So basically, they create that and then they wait for the victim to go and create an account on that site also. So like I said, there are five different methods. So there's, and we'll run through each one of these, but classic federation merge, unexpired session ID, Trojan identifier, unexpired email exchange, and non-verifying identity provider attack. So the first one, the classic federated merge. So this works by the account being created and then the subsequent account being created by the victim. And then it's using it relies on a single sign-on option as part of the account creation. And there's supposed to be a merge of those accounts when the user goes in to create that. So it ends up that the attacker and the victim both have access to the account at the same time.
That's interesting. How many of those platforms include, I mean, I guess Dropbox I can see for sure. Zoom probably has single sign-on. So some of those make sense because like Dropbox, the attacker would then have access to corporate documents as well, potentially.
Yeah, I would think corporate single sign-on would be the only instance where you do single sign-on.
Yeah. What, you don't run Active Directory in your home?
I do, but it's not federated. But anyway, so the second one is unexpired session. So the attacker creates the account, and they maintain that session when they created the account. And then when the victim comes in and signs in, that session, it remains active even after the account's created. So then the attacker then has access to everything that the victim is putting into the account or what modifications is making the account in the other chats.
That one's interesting. I wonder how they keep the session ID for so long. Like, is it active for like a day or two? Do they have some way to get the other person to sign up right then? Or are they keeping it active for months?
Well, it says here in the article, it said they would keep it active using an automated script. And my guess is that this is one of those instances where they're going to create the account, they're going to keep it active, and they're going to use some kind of lure to get the victim to attempt to create the account after they've already done it. Because really, this is not feasible to keep this up just in case someone eventually gets around to creating the account. So they're going to lure the victim to the site via some method, I'm sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because, that only makes sense if you can do that. Otherwise, you have to keep a server up constantly, keeping that going. It's ridiculous.
Right. And the thing is, they could do that with a phishing email because it would be relatively simplistic for them to get the victim to click on the link or whatever in the email, because all the links would be to the correct site. If they said, well, you get a discount or, some kind of perk or whatever for clicking this link and then logging out, it'll actually go to the correct site, and that won't tip off the victim if there's anything funny going on. Although where they sent the email from could be tricky in making that look legit. So the third one is Trojan identifier. And this combines the classic Federation and the unexpired session together. So the attacker creates the account and associates the account with the attacker's identity provider for federated authentication. So they create the account and then kind of set up for OAuth or something like that. In addition
to that, attacker is maintaining the OAuth?
Well, they would link that. I don't know if they would maintain the OAuth, but they would link it to an account that uses OAuth that they control. And then when the victim resets the password, the attacker can still get in via the federated account, even though they no longer have access to the initial email because the victim has reset the password on that method of authentication.
Right.
And via this method, they also may go in and configure the account, because some accounts will say, well, set up secondary email address or something like that. So they may go in and set the secondary email address to be one that they control also, or instead of going the other route or this type.
Yeah. And this is what I thought of when you originally described this to me, when we were originally talking, is I just figured they went in, they set it up, and then they set up the secondary email address so they could go back in after the fact. These other ones were way smarter than what I was thinking of.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say the other ones are smarter, because I think just like security, the attacker side, the more simple it is, the more likely you have success. Ocean's 11 only really probably works in the hook. I don't think you're going to get away with Ocean's 11 kind of, attack in reality. All right. So the fourth one is unexpired email change. And this was pretty interesting way of going about it. So after the account's created, the attacker submits a request for the email address to be changed for the account, but they don't confirm that they want the email change to happen. So they'll go in, they'll change the email, the site will send out a validation email to the attacker's email address that they control, but they won't click on the link in the email validation to validate that that email address was changed. And after the victim goes in and sets up the account, changes the password and everything, then they will click the change password, or I'm sorry, change email address verification, at which point within the system, the user's, the victim's email address will be replaced with the attacker's email address. They'll send a password reset, and then they'll be in the attack.
Yeah, that makes sense. Although, frankly, most places I've seen, when you get the password reset, it's like, this will expire in 24 hours.
Well, this is not a password reset, though. It's a, do you want to change your email address? And I guess what they're thinking here is that maybe there's not a time limit on that one.
I see.
Huh. All right. And then the last one is non-verifying.
Wait, hold on. Let's go back to that one. Okay. How do they know when the person's actually set up their account? How do they know when it's time to go back and claim that email change? Or they just go back every so often and check it?
I would assume that would be the way. Once they lose access to the app because password's been reset, then they know that the victim is taking over the account.
Sure.
And then the last one is non-verifying identity provider attack. So this exploit lacks the verifying ownership of an identity provider. And this is related to the cloud-based login services like Okta or OneLogin. So why all this works is that, you know, when you set up an account using your email address, what should happen is you go in and you say, hey, I want to set up this account. Here's my email address. You click submit. And then they send an email to the email address associated with the account. And until you click on the link within that verification email and go back into the site, you have no access whatsoever to whatever it is, the service that you've signed up. But the problem is that a lot of services, you'll go to your setup account, you click submit, and then it'll let you in right away and send you an email to your verification or a verification email to your account, or maybe don't send a verification at all to your email account that you've set up your account at this site. Now, because the whole point of that is to validate that the person who set up the account is the owner of the email address, which is kind of the identity for the victim or the user at the site. And of course, the reason that this is even a thing is why site owners allow for this to happen is they're trying to reduce friction for their users. So that's why they would let you into the account right away, because they don't want to, they don't want to add that friction of you going to have to check your address for you actually get access to the account. So it's one of those things where you're trading off friction for security, which you'll see a lot of one of the major trade-offs that organizations are considering when they're setting up these types of systems.
Yeah, isn't that the same reason that we talked recently about account password resets for corporate entities? It was kind of the same thing. They want to get employees back online and working with as little friction as possible.
Right. In this case, they want to improve the user experience by getting actually accessing the services right away. Yeah. Versus having to wait to check their...
No. I get it. They're trying to scale. They're trying to get as many users as possible. And frankly, a lot of users, as soon as they run into a hiccup, this happens to me with free services. If I run into one little weird thing that I have to do, I'm like, this is the dumbest thing ever. And I just drop my sign up right there and go do something else.
Yeah. And if their email system is kind of slow in any way, then they may lose that user just like, because if you say, create the account and you have to wait for that email validation to show up and it just doesn't show up for 10 or 15 minutes or something like that, like forget about it.
Yep. Do not care.
I mean, because unless it's something you're really interested in doing, you might just say, wow, this is not worth it. Or you may just give up and go to one of their competitors.
Yeah, only if it's important. So I wonder how long it's going to be before somebody creates a framework to automate this. And kind of in relation to what you said before, I wonder if it's worth creating a framework to automate this if it's supposedly so easy to not do this. Although given so many people did do it.
And now it's hard to say, because one of the things also is who you pick as your victim in this case. You know, you have to know your target really before you even start down this path. So I think while this sounds scary and it's, you know, easily fixed, I don't think it's as big a deal as some people may think out.
Also,
because one of the things to consider is that if the attacker set up the account and then you have to go up and set it up after them, then it's a brand new account. What have you done with it? Right. Yeah. So the attacker's going to have to either wait a while before you start adding value to whatever it is that account does for, or they're going to get virtually nothing out of it from the jump because there's nothing there to get.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a possibility. Although I wonder, kind of like the credential stuffing thing, I wonder if you can just go ahead and put somebody's like email address, like a known email address or a known name, and it creates a variety of email addresses, you know, that you put in Matthew Keener and it's like Matthew.Keener, Keener MS, Keener.Matthew, Matt.Keener, Matt Keener, like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then tries to create accounts for all of those just on the, but again, like you said, this, you'd have to pick somebody that's really important to justify all that effort. Although again, if it's automated.
I don't know. It comes back to really return on investment. I mean, how much time are you going to spend as an attacker going through this to get what kind of return?
Well, that's the same thing that I said. So, and this may be a case of, you know, being wrong once. So now this time I'm being the opposite, but that's what I said about the SIM swapping. I was like, that sounds like so much effort. How are you even going to figure that out? But it turns out that cryptocurrency makes it worth it. Of course, is there a justifiable use case here? Maybe there is. Did they try this with all the cryptocurrency exchanges?
I don't know, because they didn't really mention that, though, which sites they tried it on.
So I don't know. That maybe there is a valid reason to do this, because maybe checking out all those cryptocurrency exchanges might be something to do.
Yeah, because they may have this flaw.
That would be interesting to me, is we've demonstrated this kind of new class of vulnerability. And for a lot of these, it doesn't matter. Who cares if they took your Instagram account, whatever, doesn't matter. But does this work on cryptocurrency places? Does this work on bank accounts? Stuff like that.
Right. Actually, the bank account one, now that I think about it, might be one of those ones that it could pay off right away. If the flaw were there, because the account was created ahead of time. In a lot of instances, the account will be created ahead of time. There'll be money there already by the time you link the account, you know, the bank account with the online account. So that might be one of these instances where they would get an immediate payoff for accessing any financial institutions, like whether it be a bank account, brokerage account, or whatever. There could be immediate payoff in those instances as well.
Ooh, wait, brokerage account's a good one. If you see something like so-and-so reports that they're joining a new company and you can figure out what brokerage they use, you can pre-sign up and then potentially, although they would probably use their work email for it, but maybe not. Yeah, I don't know. But brokerage accounts might be a good one too. And those are ones that.
Well, you also have to figure that this is a pretty low risk attack for if you fail.
Yeah.
You know, if all this doesn't pan out or whatever, you don't get access to the account, then, the cops are not coming for you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you just have to steal the freaking Motor Lacer these days anyway for the cops to come for you.
Or be in the same country as the person you target.
Right. So, as far as this whole thing goes about what you should do about it is, you know, just be very leery when you're signing up for any kind of account. And if there's any indication that says, oh, you already have an account or something pretty suspect about that whole thing, and don't blow that off as you know, like Matt was saying before about getting a notification saying, hey, this account's been created, and just blow it off as phishing. You know, you might want to make a note of that. And then if you go up, sign up for an account anywhere that says, oh, you already have an account, just change your password. You don't think you've created an app that pretty makes things up. And ARPA also suggested that if the site allows it to set up MFA on the account right after you create it, which should also bounce any previous sessions so that the whole maintained session attack will also be.
Yeah. It sounds like you should go check the backup stuff too.
Yeah. Especially look at all the settings. Especially if it
says that you already had the account.
Yeah. Look at all your settings, I guess, or the profile or whatever associated with the account and see what's in there. Because definitely there's something hinky if you go in there and there's a backup email address set for some account you've never seen before.
Surprise.
We all flip down here.
All right. Our second article today is thousands of popular websites see what you type before you hit submit. And it's a very scary title. Article comes to us from Wired. Turns out not quite so scary, but it could be. So, generally speaking, we all assume that whatever we type into a web page, nothing is recorded until we hit submit. I don't know about you. I have maybe occasionally typed insulting things into websites that I was not happy with. But researchers from three EU universities crawled the top 100,000 websites. They pretended to be both an EU user and a user from the Americas. And they found that between 1.8% and 2.9% of sites collected data before you hit submit. It was 1.8% if you're an EU user, 2.9% if you're an American user. Additionally, they specifically found 52 websites that collected password data before you hit the submit button. The majority of these instances were not actually the websites themselves, but seemed to be through a third-party marketing and analytics service. Well, I'll cut out that part. When we were originally looking at, we were looking at a different website that talked about how 51 out of 52 of the websites that collected the password data were all using the same analytics framework, which apparently had a function in there, which allowed you to screen out the password data. So it looked like that function was being incorrectly invoked. So it was not screening out the password data.
Oh, yeah. I remember you mentioning that. Though.
Yeah. So they contacted the majority of those websites, and the majority of those websites corrected that. They didn't say about the one website that was not using that framework.
Or what their reply was.
Or what their reply was. Who the hell? Yeah. Yeah. But I find that kind of interesting that these third-party marketing and analytics services have apparently been doing this for years and nobody noticed.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure exactly how the researchers went about identifying it, whether they were scraping the Java code from the site and looking for specific things within there to indicate that that's what's going on. Well, I'm just not sure how, you know, what their methodology was for identifying sites. Because unless you're looking for it, it might be pretty hard to find.
They didn't describe the methodology in the article, and I did not read the research. So I don't know. I couldn't tell you how specifically they identified this. I don't know if they like ran this in a VM and kind of watched what the JavaScript did, but that is kind of interesting. So JavaScript, what can it do? Let JavaScript run in your browser and who knows what's going to happen. It can download malware. It can keylog you. It can steal your cookies. It can mine cryptocurrency on your machine. It is a very useful tool. I was wondering if this is an alternative to serving malware for bad guys. So typically in the past, they have compromised a site or a third party and they serve malware, but they usually get caught fairly quickly because serving malware is pretty obvious. Maybe they could be skimming passwords instead. This might be kind of lower profile. Apparently people's AV software hasn't detected this for years.
Yeah, I think that really... they really depend on how they get the data back to them, you know, how they reacquire the data.
Yeah, since this was misconfigured, maybe it wasn't really doing anything with the password data.
Because it's got to be that the data that's being collected in the keylogs is going to be stored and then transmitted somehow.
Yeah.
So it really depends on how slick they are in getting that data sent to them.
Yeah. And since this is mostly done by third-party marketing, I wonder if they're being selective at all on the types of forms they're skimming. When they were talking about this, they seem mostly focused on emails and passwords, but there's lots of different types of information that you can submit in a form. You can submit your stock orders. You can submit financial orders. You can submit medical information for tests. you can submit payment forms. Although technically bad guys have been skimming credit card information for years, but I don't know, this seems like this might be a slightly different way to do it. So again, I don't know if this is something slightly different that the attackers could target.
Yeah, I mean, there would have to be some flaw on the site for them to be able to gain access and the code on the site to begin with.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. It has the same problems as they have now in terms of adding that code to, you know, deploy malware or to skim the credit card information. The big difference would be how detectable it is. We've gotten pretty good at detecting malware being downloaded. Over the last couple of years, we've gotten a lot better at detecting the credit card skimming. I'm just wondering if they shift their tactics a little bit, if it'd be a little bit harder and they can dodge the detections for a little bit longer.
Yeah, really, because it depends on how they've written it in the JavaScript on the site. It's probably not going to set off any malware calls or whispers either.
Yeah, it's just reading your
stuff. And it's a pretty standard waterhole attack, if you will, as well.
Can you detect keystrokes only when that window is active?
What do you mean, in the browser?
Yeah.
Well, the browser, you get a browser tab. I say, it's not like they're going to be able to capture data from one tab and the other tab. When you've got the domain isolation, the browser isolation, the exact correct terminology for that. But if you're on Gmail and your bank account at the same time, you know, Gmail can't see another tab.
All right. It's a good thing we have somebody smart here. All right. After completing their paper and submitting to the conference, they actually found an additional thing. They found two marketing tracking sites that were kind of doing something similar, but they were doing it with hashed email addresses, Metapixel and TikTok Pixel, enabling tracking across websites, even if the email was obscured. And they reached out to Meta and TikTok and unfortunately did not get an response from either one of them, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting about this, you know, the fact that it's third-party stuff. So if the third party is going to gain some advantage from collecting this data, that means that they've entered into some agreement with the first-party provider. And then that first-party provider has to be sending some data to that third party. So I don't know if there's some back-end data shipping going on or something like that. So depending on how that data is transmitted and it's secured, that's also another avenue for that data to be lost as well, because it's going from that first party to the third party.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, you know, what's the point of this from a third-party perspective about collecting all that kind of data on a form? You know, if it's some kind of metrics tracking to say, this third party is going to do some analytics on your forms to say, well, most of your users get to this point and then they quit the form or something like that. And they're collecting those kind of metrics to help inform the first party about to better improve their websites, get more closure or for more users completing the entire form or something. So I'm trying to think about what's the use case for collecting this stuff as you type, because if they don't actually complete the form and hit submit, then there is a decent probability or possibility that the data within the form is going to be incorrect or incomplete. So then you've also got a huge effort on the backside to do data cleanup and normalization for what you collect on that form, because it was incomplete at the time you collected it.
Yeah. It almost looks like the submission before completion is a bug, because quoting the article, it says, both claimed in their documentation that customers could turn on automatic advanced matching, which would trigger data collection when a user submitted a form. So it looks like it's a bug. It looks like it's not supposed to grab it before they hit the submit button, or maybe it grabs it while they're in the process, but it's not supposed to send it before they hit the submit button.
So what you're saying, that a marketing company create this as a bug and not a feature?
I mean, it's a software company, or maybe it's plausible deniability. I don't know. Anyways, they submitted a bug report to Meta and have not heard an update. And they submitted a bug report to TikTok and have not heard back at all. So, well.
No, anyways, not cold with breath.
They'd be dead. So why does this matter? Yet another way you are being surveilled and you do not know about it. God forbid, one of these days they all figure their shit out and manage to tie all this stuff together. Because right now we're all being surveilled and all the data is going into hard drives, but nobody's really figured out how to tie it all together yet. We hope. What should you do about it? Well, it's not realistic to have a separate email for each site. It's not really realistic to, you know, manually keep an eye out for JavaScript, but there's a couple things you can do. You can block JavaScript. Of course, that'll also break an awful lot of the web. I don't know, David, have you ever used script blockers?
Yeah, I do. And it is a pain in the ass.
Yeah. Yeah. I used, I think it was ZBlock Origin something. Yeah. I ended up not using it because so much of the web just did not work. So I've ended up just defaulting to regular ad blockers instead of script blockers because, yeah, so much just doesn't work. So I definitely couldn't use it on work computers because work computers were, yeah. In terms of email, so I guess it really depends. I guess the script blocking really depends on your pain threshold. How much pain are you willing to go through? They used to work pretty good a couple of years ago, but as time went on, just got more and more painful. For email, it's not realistic to have a separate email for each site, but if you use Gmail, there are a couple tricks you can do. There, Gmail has the functionality that allows you to create kind of a semi-unique email address using a plus sign to add an identifier. And I think David mentioned this a couple episodes ago, but I'm going to mention it again now. If your email is david@gmail.com, you can sign up to a service as David plus ilikeprettyponies@gmail.com. And if the JavaScript doesn't account for it before hashing or when tracking, it may be counted as a different email address. So also, Gmail doesn't recognize periods in the email address. So you could do d.avid@gmail.com. And again, if the JavaScript doesn't account for it, then it'll look like a different email address. So now the downside of that is, of course, if you're using Gmail, you're letting Google go through all your email. So I'm thinking a good strategy here might be use something like ProtonMail or some other privacy-related email account for all of your truly private stuff. And then maybe use Gmail for your spam and your other signups, and then use some of these other tricks to try to create some uniqueness. You're like, this is just a nightmare. We're living in the dystopia. Although now you've got me, I think I may reinstall my script blocker.
Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. So thank you for joining us, and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.